stay connected to the world around you, KPBS brings you trusted news, compelling stories, and in-depth reporting every day. Wherever life takes you, KPBS is here, on the radio, online, and on the go. Discover more at kpbs.org.
Hey there, San Diego. It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Well, San Diego soccer fans, get ready. The playoffs are here. Major League Soccer's SDFC hosts its first ever playoff game Sunday. Today, we'll hear all about San Diego FC's record-breaking season and how they ended up the tops in their conference, plus why they're not the only hope for a championship this fall. Then, how one San Diego preschool is helping young kids recover from family trauma. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. Playoff soccer kicks off on Sunday at San Diego Snapdragon Stadium. SDFC will play the first of its best of three series against the Portland Timbers. And today we take a look at how Major League Soccer's newest team found surprising success in its first ever season. The team ended the regular season in the top spot in the Western Conference and set some records for expansion teams along the way. And early next month, the San Diego Wave FC will start its own championship push in the NWSL. Here to talk about what's happening in San Diego soccer, I'm joined by Hector Trujillo. He's a soccer writer with the Times of San Diego and El Latino. Hector, welcome to Roundtable.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. It's a pleasure.
So, you know, let's get right to, there's been some news hitting with San Diego FC. They have this big playoff game Sunday, but there's been some uncertainty with one of its star players. You know, tell us about what the latest there.
Yes, the great Chucky Lozano. He's an attention getter everywhere he goes. He's been a champion everywhere he's played. Liga MX, obviously, Europe and Holland and also Italy. And yeah, now we have confirmation in the last 24 hours that he will be available to play. Mickey Barras confirmed that, the head coach for San Diego FC. And this morning, I believe he sent an Instagram post saying to everybody how about his passion and how his passion pretty much got the best of him after being taken out. He didn't specifically mention the game, but it was a halftime of the Houston game. And he wasn't happy with that, and maybe a little words that he's regretting at the moment. But now he's looking forward based on the Instagram post, and he's going to be ready to go against Portland. They're definitely going to need a guy like him on the pitch with his experience playing internationally, Mexican national team, obviously, and somebody who's a guy that's going to bring 100%.
So, you know, not the best to have kind of some team drama on the eve of, like, you know, your first playoff run here. But I want to dig more into the playoffs a little bit more. But I want to first take a look back at the season, kind of season in a review here. What led to San Diego FC, you know, their success in this first season? Because it's pretty remarkable for an expansion team, right?
Yes. And to quote the words of many people that follow soccer, Warren Smith, who helped us bring San Diego Loyal several years ago here to San Diego. San Diego is the epicenter of soccer in North America, and I believe it. That's one of my favorite quotes that he said. There's always been a fruitful place here for the lovers of the beautiful sport on both sides of the border. Obviously, we're so close to Mexico and San Diego, Southern California area. And it was just ready for a Major League Soccer team. It caught everybody by surprise because not a lot of people were expecting it to happen, like right after, I think, San Diego Loyal mentioned that they weren't going to come back for their season. And Albion San Diego didn't come back for NISA that year that they went to the final or semifinal. So everybody was waiting for somebody to fill that void, and it came up to that announcement from Tom Penn and the leaders of San Diego FC to bring a team here that was the fans were ready for to show their passion, and they've shown it throughout the season and all the home games, that opener that I was there for. In game one, I think it was St. Louis SC, if I'm not mistaken, or somebody else. But yeah, it was like a sight to see, and I think that was the roots for what we saw for the rest of the season. And then they were better on the road this year for whatever statistical anomaly you want to mention it. But at home, they definitely brought the passion, and so did the fans, the supporters groups. Everything was just so exciting to see.
You mentioned some of the past soccer teams in San Diego that have come and gone at this point, like Loyal. You know, it took a long time for Major League Soccer to come here. And I think, you know, longtime San Diego soccer fans were used to that sort of when will it come? It took, it's been a long journey. How have you seen soccer culture sort of evolve over the last few decades?
I forgot to mention also, related to your question just now, the San Diego Soccer's, their history of winning championships, even though it's an indoor soccer league, obviously.
Numerous, right?
Various champions, yeah. Before they went up to Del Mar, and obviously after when they played in the Pechanga Arena, now they're in Oceanside. So it's just a long, I think the connection, I can't undervalue this, to the border and the back and forth of all the fans, the family members, the friends who just have, it's almost like every game you go to is almost like a World Cup game. Maybe we'll talk about the World Cup later, but it's just that intensity, that sense of pride in where you're from, that sense of pride in your heritage. It can never be ignored, and people show it. The fans show it on the stands. Sometimes they go overboard, but the players definitely show it on the pitch, even though they might not always get the results. So I think it's just that sport that brings the integral part of who we are as a human, not just as an individual, but connected to the community, I think.
You mentioned, sometimes the fans taking it overboard. There have been a couple examples of that here with San Diego FC, I think it's fair to say, earlier in the season. Started with a homophobic chant that happened. I think that was the first home game. I'm not sure if that happened in the second. After that, it seemed to be addressed, but that caught a lot of attention. And then there was, a viral video. There was a big fight between opposing fans involving San Diego FC. Can you talk a little bit about those, early incidents and how has the team, how have you seen soccer culture kind of like recover from that or respond to those early issues?
Yeah, and this is where I have to give props to Mikey Varas. I like to call him Miguelito because he reminds me of my cousin, and that's his nickname, Miguelito. But there was a zero tolerance policy. As soon as that happened, like that, right after, during the post-game interviews, he was like, we're not going to accept that. Anybody that does that is not part of the community that we want to build here. And that's one of the critiques that I've always had with Liga MX. Sometimes the ownership groups or the coaches will turn the blind eye because they're selling tickets, fans are having fun, buying beers, whatever. But here with Mickey Barras and San Diego, it's like, this is not tolerated. And I think that the fans did a good job in responding and understanding that that's no joke. We can't be having that in any situation in society, especially with kids and families there. And also with the one that you mentioned against LAFC, that was an unfortunate incident as well. Still, there's controversy as to who started what. I'm sure there's a lot of pictures still online. Videos can refer to, they came over here, we came over there. Whatever happened there, also San Diego FC and Mikey Varas were really adamant about, this is not who we represent. This is not who we want to be as a team, as a city. So in that sense, I'm glad that they had that zero tolerance policy and they're unambiguous as to, this is not what we want to be as a city or as a team.
Well, now let's move to, what happens on the pitch and talk about, some of the success they've seen this season. One name that jumps, to the top of on the stat sheet is Anders Dreyer. Tell us about him and what he's brought to the team this year.
An absolute incredible signing. National team for Denmark. I think he scored recently 2 goals against Belarus, and he's had a whale of a season. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on who you root for, Messi's going to be the MVP. Anders Dreyer's on there among the nominees. He's going to get some votes, I'm sure. But 19 goals, 18 assists, or 19 and 19, I think it might have been actually. But he's set the record for, if I'm not mistaken, road games, complementing or being helping out with goals and assists if you combine them, and specifically in road games for the Major League Soccer. And he's just one of those guys that you see him on the pitch. He reminds me a little bit of a Chucky, but he's almost a very dedicated. Once you see him on if you saw the game against Portland recently, the 4 goals, he scored 2 of them. He's a one-on-one. He knows he's going to score. There's no goalkeeper in the world that can beat him one-on-one. And he's always looking at, he's not just a selfish player. He's always looking to see who's open. If he's got a player in front of him or is a position where he can't take a shot, he's almost like Michael Jordan. He's early with San Diego. He looks for options. It's not just him scoring, but he's so talented that he's always going to create chances for himself. He was a rose in the desert, as they like to say. So he's gonna be a big guy for the playoff run.
Wow, Michael Jordan comparison. That's
yeah, and it's his first year, so I'm on the record for that already.
Wow. Well, I mean, someone else, you know, getting accolades is Coach Mike Yavaris. You've talked a little bit about him already, but he is a candidate for Coach of the Year in the MLS. What is it about, you know, his coaching that has just made a difference with, you know, their performance on the field, right? As I understand it, he's like very offensive-minded. Is that where to kind of characterize his approach?
He's offensive-minded, but efficiently offensive-minded. He's not just throw numbers to the front and see what happens, and hopefully we get a call or hopefully a ball bounces our way. He's very efficient in his style of play. Maybe it's his pedigree with the U.S. men's national team, having coached with them as well, alongside Greg Berhalter. But, yeah, he's one of those guys that every possession counts. He's fine working from all the way from the back. He understands the tempo. He's one of those old school guys that I grew up watching in the 1980s. He understands the feel of each game is different. The opponent is different. It's almost like a chess game with him. He has to be thinking three steps ahead of the opponent to understand what they're going to be doing or what they might be doing before they even do it. So he's one of those guys that doesn't waste an opportunity. And if he needs to make a correction to one of his tactics from either a halftime or during the second half, he's not afraid to do so. So very flexible, but very, like I said, old school minded, which I like. There's not a lot of coaches. He's the only coach in the Western Conference who got nominated for Coach of the Year. And if he doesn't win it, I'll be on the record again. It'll be a robbery. I'm going to call FIFA and be like, what's going on here? This guy, because the coach for Philadelphia, he already had a great team in front of him. So they were a favorite to win the East, and the other coach as well. So I think it should be hands down. Whoever doesn't vote for Mickey Varas will be hearing from me.
I want to bring in Alejandro Villaseñor now. He joins us from the SDFC's training grounds. He's with San Diego.football. Alejandro, welcome back. I mean, did you get a chance to catch up? We've just heard Hector talking about San Diego FC's Mike Yavaris and kind of the coaching job he's done. Did you get a chance to hear from him this morning?
Yeah, thank you, Andrew, for giving me the opportunity to join in. And apologies for running a little late. They ran practice a little later today. But yeah, I got the opportunity to speak with head coach Mike Yavaris, and he gave us a good perspective on where the team is at. And I will say on the Chucky Lozano update, he stayed consistent, saying that they're handling everything internally. He did not confirm or deny any reports from other outlets, whether it was a disciplinary thing or anything like that. But he's fairly confident of where the team is at currently.
Great. I mean, well, that's good to get. We heard a little bit of an update of how things were looking. So it's good to hear that. What else have you been hearing and seeing this morning?
Yeah, so Chucky Lozano did train this whole week with the team. Mikey did not confirm if he's going to be starting or suiting up or being available off the bench as well, which is the biggest news that San Diego FC has this week. They're ready to face Portland as they faced them on decision day last week. And again, they talked a little bit about the playoff format, but we spoke with Captain Jeff Esfresco, who just got extended today till 2027 with a club option to 2028. He's the captain and heart and soul of this team. So it's an important piece of the puzzle for San Diego FC moving forward. And he, as a captain, expressed that he's excited for the playoffs. The team is ready. He's never felt the team was more confident than ever, as they should be, right? Being the first place in the Western Conference.
Alejandro, we were talking with Hector just about taking a look back at what led to just the, you know, success they found so quickly here. What stands out to you about the regular season from SDFC in their first year?
Yeah, I think they surprised everyone. Every MLS expert had them finishing dead last in the season, and it all has to do with the right to dream style that they play, right? We've talked about it throughout the season. Is that style going to work in MLS? Is it not going to work? And I think San Diego FC has proven to stay consistent and prove everyone wrong, to be honest. I think for them to finish first in the West is probably the biggest accomplishment they could have done. And again, this is a city of sports where, you know, San Diego sports has to prove everybody else wrong, and they're doing just that.
And Alejandro, you talked a little bit about the playoff format. Could you break that down? I mean, San Diego FC, they begin their first best of three series on Sunday at Snapdragon. But break down how the playoffs work in this league.
Yeah, for anyone that may not know, playoffs in MLS is very different than everywhere else in the world. The first round is a best of three match. So they play at home this Sunday against Portland. They'll play next weekend in Portland. if it's a tied 1-1, so San Diego wins one game, Portland wins another game, they'll play a third game in Snapdragon Stadium. There are no ties in playoffs, so if the game ends in a tie, they go straight to penalties. Whoever advances, then is the Western Conference semifinals, which if San Diego advances, that would also be in San Diego. That's a single elimination match, as well as the conference championship single elimination match. And then the MLS Cup will also be a single elimination match.
So still a ways to go there before we get to that, Hector. But let's talk about this matchup with Portland. How do the teams match up and what stands out to you?
I might be in the minority on this, but I think that game against Portland where San Diego FC won 4-0 was a little bit of an anomaly, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But the first game between the two sides where they finished 0-0, I think it's more aligned with what the two teams are. I do think San Diego FC is a more cohesive and efficient team. And I was actually hoping that Real Salt Lake would beat Portland because in soccer, it's almost like there's nothing else to compare it to. The adrenaline and the emotion and the pride gets to you sometimes as a player. If you remember that your last game of the regular season in front of the home fans was losing 4-0 and forcing you to play a wild card game, that's going to be in the back of your mind. So I think the first game here on Sunday is going to be huge. San Diego FC should come out with the win at their favorite. I think 2-1 favorites right now. And if I had to pick a score right now, I'd probably go 2-1 San Diego FC. But you do not want to go back to Portland needing a win there, considering how they finished the regular season and still in the back of their minds.
Alejandro, I mean, what are you looking for in Sunday's game against Portland?
Yeah, I mean, this format is very interesting, right? San Diego and Portland have faced each other at least three times already. They faced each other in preseason at the Coachella Invitational, where Portland got a 3-1 win. And they faced each other twice during the season. The first game was a 0-0 draw, and then San Diego FC currently, like, recently won 4-0, right? So I agree with Hector. San Diego FC should be winning this game at home, but historically this season, San Diego FC hasn't been the best at home either. They had the best away record in MLS. So I can definitely see them winning it in Portland. I think it'll be a two-game series. I don't see it going to three. It also depends on how Portland approaches the match. They could easily stay back and defend and play for the penalties and hope for the best there, which that could implicate some challenges for San Diego FC. But I do see San Diego winning out the series with two games.
And Chiva, if I'm not mistaken, there's no extra time. It goes straight to penalties, right?
Yeah, correct. It goes straight to penalties, so there's no extra time, which that could only lead to Portland's advantage.
Yeah, their goalkeeper's really good at stopping penalties. Let's finish it in the regulation time.
Well, we'll continue our conversation with our local soccer experts here in just a moment. And we'll also catch up on San Diego's other professional soccer team, San Diego Wave FC, in their push for a championship this year. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
Figuring out the right sport for your kid can feel overwhelming. I'm taking that journey with my son, Dorian, exploring different sports and revisiting the fields that I grew up playing. Together, we're searching for the right fit and maybe reconnecting with a few old memories along the way. It's Game Time Decision, a new series from KPBS. Join us at kpbs.org/gametime.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Today we're talking all about San Diego soccer as San Diego's MLS team, SDFC, gets ready for its first ever playoff game this Sunday. I'm joined by Alejandro Villaseñor from sandiego.football, along with Times of San Diego's Hector Trujillo. I want to talk about San Diego's other playoff-bound soccer club here in town, Hector, and that's San Diego Wave FC. They clinched their playoff berth with a win last weekend, and it's kind of a common occurrence for them to be playoffs. They were another expansion team that kind of found success early, like SDFC. How would you characterize their season? Because there have been some ups and downs with the Wave this season, I'd say.
Yes, it's absolutely been a roller coaster of a season. Not that SDFC's hasn't, but now they find themselves, they already clinched the playoff spot, as you said, and with a strong chance of potential of getting a home game for the first round. They're currently in fifth place, 37 points, and they have a great goal differential, largely because they beat Chicago 6-1. That thing could have ended 9-1 if it wasn't for Lissanier making some incredible saves. They bounced back from that heartbreaker a couple weeks ago to Washington, losing on a last-second goal and turned it around to beat the Utah Royals. So now they control their own destiny to have a home playoff game here if they can beat Kansas City. Kansas City is the best team by far this season in the league and WSL, but they might be resting a lot of their starters just for precautionary reasons. Don't want to get any injuries, don't want to get any red cards that might affect them in the playoffs. And the two teams right ahead of them, Seattle, and Gotham's behind them. The two teams ahead of San Diego Wave are going to be playing each other, so that they're going to be taking points away from themselves, and a draw would really definitely help out San Diego Wave. So this roller coaster of a season turned around just at the right time. Jonas Adebal has done a great job getting the team refocused and getting the stars to play to their potential, especially Cascarino, who's my favorite on the team. She's just so talented. And if they can finish off with a win here, you never know, just like they say in the playoffs, going strong, going playing your best, and going healthy, you never know what could happen.
And Alejandro, San Diego Wave FC, there's been just a lot of new faces, right? There's like new coach, new players, new ownership, right? You know, tell us about this new team and how different it is from the Wave a season ago.
Yeah, like you said, right? It's new everything for San Diego Wave, from moving on from Casey Stoney, moving on from different ownership as well. Last season was without a doubt the biggest downfall that I personally see of the sports teams, considering the first two seasons that were playoff teams, and then the way the season ended, not making playoffs and being one of the bottom teams on the table. Jonas Adebal came into this team and really turned things around for San Diego Wave. Again, all these NWSL experts had San Diego Wave finishing dead last as well when they did their predictions early in the season. And San Diego Wave, in the first half of the season, proved to be probably, if not the second best or top three team in the league. Kansas City's in a league of their own this season. They're just phenomenal, and it's going to be hard to beat them. But San Diego Wave was proving to be one of the best teams in the NWSL. After the summer break, they kind of dipped in form a little bit. The confidence seemed a little shaken off. But like Hector said, they had two back-to-back wins already. They're going to face against Kansas City, who will probably rest some players. Their best player, Chawingo, is also injured in the last game as well. So San Diego Wave has a very unique chance of hosting a playoff game this season as well. And all due to the changes that they made during the season. They got a new GM in Cami as well, and she's made some decisions as well. They've moved away from the assistant coach a couple of weeks ago as well. And since that move, San Diego Wave has also been playing better. So a lot of moving components for San Diego Wave this year.
You know, I think one thing we've talked about in the past on the show with the SDFC coming into the picture was how it might impact San Diego Wave and just, you know, the connection with fans and how much they've connected to the community here. You know, were those concerns overblown? Like how have the Wave, been... how have the Wave responded with having an MLS team here as well?
Yeah, I think they were go ahead, Chiba.
Sorry, Hector. I think it has worked out well for both clubs. I think they have a very important partnership together. They cheer on each other, especially making playoffs. I think maybe it was a little overblown before the season started. I think something that have impacted San Diego Wave's attendance more so than San Diego FC being in town is moving away from Naomi Girma, who was their best player in the season, to move overseas to Chelsea in England. And then Alex Morgan also retired last season, right? So those were two key players that were drawing a large amount of people into the stadium. So I think that's one of the things that maybe impacted that attendance.
Yeah, Hector.
No, I was just going to agree with Chiba. It's kind of like, it's a little bit overblown because it's almost like saying you can't be an SDFC and a Cholos de Tijuana fan or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's so much, like I said, San Diego is a fruitful place for soccer of any division, of any league. And yeah, I mean, the better one team does, it almost pushes the other fan base to make their team play better when they're being represented or they're at the home games. So I think it's a yin-yang kind of relationship. I never saw it as a competitive, like, if you're my fan, you can only be my fan kind of thing, which is what she was saying. It's kind of, they overlap really, really well.
You mentioned the Cholos there. You're right. We have more than just those teams. You mentioned the Soccers, and there's the Cholos in Tijuana. What can you tell us about them this season?
The last time I checked, they were doing pretty good in Liga MX this season. They just had a friendly up against Capo FC from Niza. And they did pretty well up there. They have four more. They're signed up to do four more exhibition games with SDFC. The last one they played here at Snapdragon, SDFC came out on top 4-2. They're a team that brings a lot of fans from San Diego to go watch them at home. I know Craig Elston and I know Darren Smith are huge fans of them as well. So, yeah, it's again, there's, in this area, the epicenter, again, I'll repeat that, we're the epicenter of soccer in North America. You can't go wrong. And I think it's not competition. It's more pushing the other teams and the other leagues to do better.
Well, then,
and I think,
go ahead, Alejandro.
Sorry, Andrew, something to add about Cholos that it's important to take notice is that right now they have a 16-year-old player named Gilberto Mora, who is a generational player, as they're calling him. They're getting ready to potentially end up signing him or sending him to Europe to a team in the near future once he turns 18. But this player is special, and it is exciting that he is playing just across the border here from San Diego. If anybody's listening, if you want the chance of witnessing a very excellent player at such a young age, definitely go check out Cholos.
Yeah, he had a great showing in the recent U-20 World Cup, Chiva, too. You know, he was awesome for Mexico.
So, I mean, you kind of said it, just the San Diego, Tijuana region really being this soccer epicenter, right, Hector? Part of that, you know, San Diego FC is trying to tap into that with its Right to Dream Academy. I don't know, Alejandro, I don't know what you can say. You're out there now where that, you know, that facility is going to be, right? How does that fit into tapping into this epicenter that Hector was just talking about?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I actually got the opportunity to come out to the campus tour when they officially launched the academy and got to see the classrooms, got to see the library, got to talk to some of the kids that are living here already. I spoke to some of the teachers as well. And what they're learning here is very different than the basic education that someone would have in a public school. It's honestly spectacular to see. They train every day and then they have schooling every day as well. Sometimes they have 2 days with school where they'll have classes that are only 2 hours long and then 4 hours long. They get to see their families over the weekend. We got to talk to players that are from Vegas, from Tijuana, from Guadalajara, from really all over the nation and some parts of Mexico as well. And it's truly phenomenal to see.
So you mentioned Guadalajara there. I'll kind of move on to another soccer story that maybe, you know, not catching a lot of headlines right now, but will be in about 6 months or so. And that's the FIFA World Cup is coming to North America starting in June. It's, you know, games are going to be played in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. I think the closest games to us will be in Los Angeles, right? But Guadalajara is another site, Mexico City, other places in the U.S. I mean, Hector, I guess just can you talk a little bit about what that means and what people should be kind of preparing for of, you know, World Cup coming to near our shores?
Yeah, I think it all started with the Copa America recently. Obviously, Mexico and the U.S. didn't have their best showing in the most recent Copa America, but the energy levels just started. You could sense it here in this area, cross-border area, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada as well. It's going to be something that's historic. I know South Korea and Japan had one in 2002 where they shared venues and stuff. So if they can use that blueprint to how successful that one was, I think it'll be a knockout historic kind of situation here that it's going to be unforgettable for generations to come. Obviously, people are going to be bringing their patriotism from both sides of the board. I'm not going to not disregard Canada because they got a hell of a team as well. But, you know, everybody's going to want to see, you know, Mexico do well, the U.S. do well, and maybe meet each other in the knockout stage. I'm going to try to make it up to L.A. I know Chiva and Tony are getting press credentials for that, so you can, the guys can hook me up. It'd be much appreciated. But I'm going to have that, even for the ones that I can't, depending on what time the games are, I'm going to have it on TiVo. I'm going to be recording everything. It's going to be something for, you can tell your generation's kids, grandkids, that it happened here in my lifetime.
Alejandro, talk to me about the World Cup. I mean, there will be potentially San Diego FC players playing in that tournament as well, right? But, you know, put that into perspective for us, what the World Cup means coming to the States and Mexico.
Yeah, no, the World Cup is huge, right? I mean, it's probably the biggest sporting event in the world. It's bigger than the Super Bowl, bigger than the NBA Finals, you name it. It happens every 4 years, and the chance for the U.S. to host it another tournament, including with Mexico and Canada, is phenomenal. There's going to be 10 games being played in Mexico, 10 games being played in Canada, and the rest of the games will be played here in America. The final is going to be in New York, I believe, at MetLife Stadium, which mm-hmm. is a really nice stadium to have, and New York also being a very big soccer city as well. It's exciting. It's fun. I think the biggest plus for anyone living in this region is that you're not going to have to wake up at 3 a.m. to watch soccer games as you had to do in the last World Cup in Qatar, right? You're not going to have to stay up late or anything like that. The games are going to be maybe while you're at work or while you're off work, 3, 5, 7 p.m. So it's going to be really nice.
Can you imagine L.A. traffic for the Mexico games, Chiva? I was going to take the public transportation, dude.
It's going to be insane.
It's going to be insane.
I believe Mexico's playing, I believe, their three group matches in Mexico. And then, I mean, playoff could be anything. With Mexico's history, they never make it past the round of 16. So we'll see if that's a difference here. But yeah, like you said, Andrew, San Diego FC has a chance to have Chucky Lozano potentially be in this Mexican national team for the 2026 World Cup. And as well as Andrew Dreyer could be called up for Denmark. So it's definitely exciting to see.
Well, I mean, just so much to talk about, and there's going to be a whole lot more coming up. I mean, we'll all be watching on Sunday following San Diego FC's road in the playoffs, and then later this month with Wave. I've been speaking with Alejandro Villaseñor from San Diego Football, along with Times of San Diego soccer writer Hector Trujillo. I want to thank you both for being here on Roundtable.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
See you at the buffet table, Chiva.
When we come back, we hear about a local preschool dedicated to helping kids who have faced trauma in their young lives. Roundtable's back after the break.
Stay connected to the world around you. KPBS brings you trusted news, compelling stories, and in-depth reporting every day. Wherever life takes you, KPBS is here, on the radio, online, and on the go. Discover more at kpbs.org.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. 63% of U.S. adults reported an adverse childhood experience before age 18. This includes abuse, witnessing violence, or family separation. That's according to the National Survey of Children's Health. One preschool in San Diego is dedicated to supporting students who have experienced family trauma, like domestic violence. Students like James Jabot, his mom Elizabeth, tried to shield him from that violence.
There was a lot of ups and downs and just a lot of situations where it would become dangerous. And yeah, it led to, you know, domestic violence, unfortunately. And I kind of knew that that's not what I wanted for my child.
Their story is front and center in a three-part reporting series by Cal Matters. It details takeaways from local preschool's commitment to survivors of family trauma. Cal Matters assistant visuals editor Adriana Haltis joins me now to talk more about her reporting. Adriana, welcome to Roundtable.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Mm-hmm. We just heard Elizabeth Jabot there talk about her son, James. Tell me about her and how she discovered this preschool called Mi Escuelita.
Yeah. Elizabeth Jabot is a mom, a young mom, and she unfortunately was in a relationship that led to some domestic violence, physical, emotional, financial. And she knew that she didn't want that future for her son. So she started to look for research or resources that she could find to help her, to help James, because she had noticed a change in his behavior. He was normally pretty quiet, a well-behaved kid, but she noticed that he was having anxiety whenever she wasn't around and was, you know, throwing a little bit more tantrums. So she wanted something that could help him. She reached out to his pediatrician, but they really couldn't provide the support and help that, that she really needed. And she was doing some research online when she came across Mi Escuelita, which is a therapeutic preschool for kids who have been affected by domestic violence or other family-related traumas. And so she looked into it and decided to enroll James.
And Elizabeth really, you know, credits the school with helping her son quite a bit. Here's a little bit of what she told you.
I felt that only Mi Escuelita kind of understood kids who have gone through traumatic experiences, but also, like, had the experience and experts who are able to handle that. I don't feel like a typical school would have been able to help my child the way that Mi Escuelita has.
So, I mean, you hear that there, just kind of how they do it. But what are some of the challenges that come with teaching young kids who've faced trauma like James?
Yeah. Well, children who have experienced trauma can show it in different ways, right? Some may become more explosive in their behavior. Some may become more timid. You may see some of them cry a little bit more or throw tantrums. And having experts that know those signs that can, you know, that can speak in a child's language and really sort of parse through some of the things that the surface level things and really get to deep down to some of the things that they may be experiencing, I think is important, especially for children who are so young, right?
Like, mm-hmm.
Or preschool age, right? They might not know how to express themselves or express their emotions. So having experts that understand their language and that can really, you know, extract that from them and sort of get down to, like, the root of the problem, I think it's super important, especially for a kid whose brain is developing at that age.
Yeah. And you also spoke to Lisa Klemp, that's preschool's director. She talked to you about, you know, just kind of how trauma can have really lasting impacts, often leading to kind of repeated behaviors, I think she mentioned, you know. How is Mi Escuelita trying to change that?
Yeah, so mental health is at the forefront of Mi Escuelita. All the kids who attend there have had to go through some type of trauma. And domestic violence is usually the one that a lot of the kids have been affected by. At Mi Escuelita, every kid receives one-on-one therapy sessions with a clinician. They also participate in group therapy sessions with other students where they learn how about their emotions, how to identify them, and sort of how to regulate them. And their families also are able to receive services. They are able to receive therapy themselves. If kids need, you know, sort of therapy related to like a sibling, because sometimes siblings fight, that is also something that is available. And there are programs for parents, for parent engagement, so that they can learn, you know, the signs as well and how to support their child if they are going through trauma.
And here's a little bit more of what Lisa Klemp told you.
Having the staff, the support in the moment to be able to stop and pause and then have a conversation and reteach that by modeling, you know, giving them strategies of taking a break, using their words, taking deep breaths. It's really great when we get to hear from a family member that their little kiddo went home and said, "Mom, just pause and take a deep breath," right? So they hear it. They hear it and they're learning it with us all day, every day.
I mean, I think that just illustrates what you've been highlighting there, but also, you know, how this impacts the whole family. You also wrote an accompanying story that delved more into, you know, what you took away from your time at the school. Yeah. What are some of the things you found?
Yeah, well, I think the main thing is that it's working, right? The school has seen some results. A recent study by UC San Diego found that 82% of the students at Mi Escuelita scored above average on the kindergarten readiness test, which evaluates, you know, how prepared students are when they enter kindergarten. And then another UC San Diego study, which followed Mi Escuelita students over the course of several years, showed those students who attended Mi Escuelita tended to score at the same level or sometimes higher in math, reading, and writing compared to other students in a nearby school district. So it's shown that there is a benefit to providing these mental health services at such a young age.
And what other, what can other educators or even nonprofits, do you think, take away from the school's approach or even incorporate some of what you observed there?
Yeah. The thing is that a lot of places do not, there's not a lot of therapeutic schools across California. Mi Escuelita is not the only one, but it's not something that is common. And, you know, it can be a little bit difficult to implement all the things, right, that Mi Escuelita is doing. The one thing that we can learn from the school is, you know, how can we implement, even though we can't replicate it exactly, can we grab certain things from their mental health services that we can, you know, provide at other schools, right? Is it, whether it be one-on-one therapy, those group therapy sessions, or, you know, providing curriculum that is centered around social emotional learning. So I think that's sort of one of the main things is how can we implement it in other schools? If it's not exactly, what can we grab from that?
I want to take a look, you know, closer look into how you found this school, why mm-hmm. you wanted to tell their story. Could you kind of give yeah. us the little, you know, backstory? Why was this a story so important for you?
Yeah. So before I started working at CalMatters, I used to work for the San Diego Union Tribune, and I was one of the photographers on staff, and I would be assigned to take photos of everyday life in San Diego. One of those assignments was to take photos of a preschool graduation, and this was Mi Escuelita. And the only thing I know about Mi Escuelita was that it was a school for kids who have been affected by trauma. So when I went to the graduation, it was really beautiful. The kids sang a song, and the song was about thanking their families, about, you know, supporting them. And a lot of the family members were in the audience, and, you know, I saw them tear up a little bit. And so it was hard not to feel emotional at that moment, just knowing a little bit of the background of the school. And I definitely wanted to learn more about it. And I didn't get a chance while I worked there, but now working at CalMatters, I thought about that school again. I was going through some of my old photos, and I saw the photos of the graduation, and I said to myself, man, I would love to, like, really be inside that school to see how these kids are benefiting from all these services. And thankfully, I was able to do that.
And, you know, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm just wondering if you can briefly talk a little bit about how you approached the story visually. As you mentioned, you're a photographer. To tell us about how you wanted to show this story, because that can be a difficult thing for folks to visualize, to talk about something serious, you know, as serious as domestic violence, right?
Right. My goal was always to make this a visual story first, to really show the people impacted by domestic violence. It's obviously a really hard thing to talk about. And a lot of times, you know, we want to protect our sources and the people who have experienced it, because we want to make sure that they are safe. But when they do feel comfortable in sharing their stories and being open about it, I think visuals are really important, because visuals are just, you know, that saying, you know, a photo's worth a thousand words, right? They're just impactful. They bring out emotions. They make you see the severity of an issue. So for me, that was important to show that domestic violence does affect the whole family, and it affects kids who are so young as well.
You also highlighted resources for families who have experienced trauma. We have about, you know, 30 seconds or so left, but I'm wondering if you can share some of those resources with us.
Yes. Well, first, if you are a parent and you are seeing that a child might be struggling with trauma, you, one thing is keep note of their behavior. Are there any changes? Are they sleeping more, eating less? Are they acting out a little bit more? Are they more timid? Keep note of that. And if you do see changes, I would encourage you to visit the First Five California website where they provide more tips and resources on the next steps following them.
Well, Adriana, I want to thank you for sharing more about your reporting. Adriana's three stories are out now. They can be found on the CalMatters website or also on kpbs.org. We have a story about the San Diego preschool, Mi Escuelita. Adriana Haldís is an assistant visuals editor with CalMatters. And Adriana, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
If you or a loved one are in need of support, you can go to firstfive.com or head to the National Domestic Hotline at 800-799-7233. More resources are at our website, kpbs.org. That'll do it for this edition of the KPBS Roundtable. Thanks so much for listening. You can listen to the show anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays, again, Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show or ideas for a future one, you can always email us at roundtable@kpbs.org. You can also leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producer this week was Brandon Trufa. The show was produced by Ashley Rush. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm your host, Andrew Bracken. Thanks again for listening and have a great weekend.
Start your day with Morning Edition and wind it down with All Things Considered, only on KPBS. From global headlines to local stories, stay informed, inspired, and connected. Tune in daily or listen anytime at kpbs.org.